Movie Podcast. I am Tom Chick, and with me today we have Christian Miransky.
Yes, hello everyone. I'm Christian Mislansky.
Right, and we'll just call you Dingus for the duration of the podcast, if that's okay.
Oh, I can see where you'd get that from that name.
It's derived from Dingus. Yeah, they're both German. We also have Kelly Wand. Kelly, say hello.
Hello. You didn't introduce me the way I asked.
Oh, Kelly Wand.
You didn't mention my qualification, talk about movies on the internet, which has a very high pedigree.
Now, you actually are qualified to talk about movies on the internet because you write about them. And I actually was hoping that you would provide folks some easy way to sort of get to your reviews, because it's like a long URL, isn't it? Like, you don't have like a domain or anything, right?
I do, but it's boring.
It's not boring. So,
but
it's called like Sprocket Hold. Spell
it's
that.
Called Sprocket Hold. It's S-P-R. I didn't know there'd be math. S-P-R-O-C. It's Sprocket Hold. Just type that every spelling. And
like the word sprocket and then H-O-L-D, like you're holding a sprocket.
It's the dumb guy who says random stuff on this, but writing. So it's completely different. Also, what I said to do was introduce me as the writer of the Jumper video game, which is something I think people would be interested in and might get them interested in movie viewing in general.
Now, I played that video game, and do you have any ill will towards me based on what I wrote in my review of that video game?
I didn't read what you wrote.
Okay.
Yes, I do. Whatever it was. Anyway, and I know your qualifications include that you interviewed Steven Spielberg.
I did, right? Yes. I did once interview, and I was once in a movie, too.
Right. Which one was that?
It was a Western where I play a bounty hunter tracking down Rob Lowe. And I'm not making any of this. This is true, by the way. Just like Kelly is not inventing the thing about the Jumper game. That's true as well.
Yeah, that is true.
So, Dingus, what are your qualifications for being here?
My qualifications are that I see a lot of movies.
Yeah, and he said smart stuff on the last podcast. So it's not like we're PAs or anything.
So all around, right? I think we all belong here. And now what kind of spoiled it with the musical cue, but what movie?
Oh, that was orchestral. Just like I wanted.
No, that was not
nice orchestral.
But it was topical because we all saw Where the Wild Things Are this past week.
Yeah. I thought the threesome with Denise Richards and Nave Campbell was too tasteful.
Oh, you saw the wrong movie. I was worried that was going to happen.
Podcast canceled.
did you happen to see that thing with the big Muppets?
I did.
Okay, that's the one we're going to talk about. So as long as you've seen that, you're okay.
Okay. I'm ready. I have a bombshell.
Who's going to start on this? Because I don't – none of us – so this is almost like a magic trick on stage where you call someone up and you say, have we discussed this trick before? None of us have talked to each other about what we think of the movie. So this is new to all of us.
So if
none
it's
of
boring.
This is rehearsed. None of this is pre-planned. So I don't know what's going to happen.
I thought it was the best possible movie that could have been made from the 40-word-long Maurice Sendak literary classic. And, wait for it, I walked out 45 minutes into it.
Wait.
So you
– how do you do that?
Yeah. I was getting the skunk eye, and I wasn't enjoying it. And it was like the 15th music video in a row, and I got bored, and I left.
The skunk eye? What does that mean?
Well, from the person I brought to the movie. But I was feeling skunk eye. I was feeling my own skunk eye.
So
and
what
I did leave. So I'm not – yes.
Well, you're confessing to us, Kelly Wand, that you have not seen this movie.
I saw the first half, and I walked out of it. Now that's
actually less qualified than I am to talk about movies on the internet.
I read the script, and I've seen half the movie. So I
I think, Kelly Wand, you have I get what you're saying, and I got that inclination at times myself. But I think you're missing what Dave Eggers did with this movie by having not stuck it out. Okay, so for our listeners, Dave Eggers editor of what McSweeney's and sort of all around literary genius, wrote the script for this.
There was a Charlie Kaufman draft that was rejected by Warner Brothers for being too weird. So that's the one I want to read.
Kelly, are you serious about that?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
What did it
mean? I mean, serious. I didn't read. I'd kill to read it. You mean the Charlie Kaufman one?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. That's not the one they gave me. They gave me the Dave Eggers one, which I thought took out everything about the book that was iconic.
Let me just ask this of both of you, Tom and Kelly. Do you guys remember the book? Seriously?
Yeah, no, I had to read it. I remember the text of the book. Whenever I don't walk out of, I mean, I sat through Jennifer's Body, so it takes a lot to get me to walk out of a movie. But it's whenever I do, it's always about the writing. And the text of the book is very sparse, but each word's chosen so carefully and meticulously, and it's just poetic and beautiful, and it just matches. Like, everyone remembers the illustrations first. But if you just read the text and don't look at the pictures, it just stays with you. It's like each word's just a bead.
That's beautifully put, Kelly. It is absolute poetry.
Well, Dingus, this is something I wanted to ask you about because I, unlike you, I don't have a 5-year-old son, so I haven't been reading the book lately. And unlike Kelly, I didn't have to, you know, I didn't read the script and I didn't possibly work on adapting it to a video game. I'm not saying that Kelly did. So I haven't seen the book in forever, and I only saw the movie earlier today, so I didn't get a chance to go read it. So Dingus, tell us a little bit about, because I know you've read the book recently. I know it's something you read to your son. Tell us a bit about how, for you, the movie and the book relate or don't relate.
I have to say that I had a really hard time with this movie because I was looking at it as an adaptation, and I think it utterly fails as an adaptation. And I think what you said a minute ago about failing to understand what Dave Eggers was doing with the script or with the movie, I might have failed in that as well, because I was really thinking the book is very fresh for me because of what you just said. I read it with my son a bit. It's sitting right here at my feet. It was easy for me to put my hands on it and look at it again. And I, you know, to be honest, I don't know if the whole endeavor was misguided from the jump. Just the idea of, as Kelly said, making something that's 40 words. I think it's more like 300 something.
No.
Into a feature like film might be misguided with all that they're trying to shoehorn in there. But my problem is, as I said a minute ago, is I'm evaluating it as an adaptation, and I'm not sure the film was made that way.
Spike Jonze and Maurice Sendak, like, they originally tussled a little over the fact that the bedposts don't turn into trees, which to me is the most iconic image from that.
Oh, but yeah.
Maurice Sendak eventually relinquished that idea and said, go make your own movie, go make your own vision, which they were friends for a long time before that. And I don't know if it was the right decision. I think something's missing. I think when you read that book, that's the first image you want to see in the movie. And there's something about it. There's something about the idea of Max controlling things and making the bedposts into trees consciously. Like, he's always in control in the book and every page. He's instantly king. He's instantly in charge of the rumpus. And in the movie, in the book, he has like this Pippi Longstocking quality kind of, where he's, and even though the monsters get bigger every page, he's still leading them. But in the book, I think some of that's lost.
No, that's I was thinking about that, Kelly, and I went back and read it, and in the movie he sort of stumbles upon claiming the title of king, and in the book actually the actual text says and they made him king, and I think the real problem for me, and again trying to look at this through the lens of adaptation, isn't so much the bedpost image, it's that it's not in his room. The moment the moment he runs out of the house and she chases him out of the house, and I realize he's going to run off into the woods somewhere and he's not going into his room, and that's where this interpretation is going, I realized you missed the point of the book totally. And I was lost.
Yeah.
Well, here's the question I have then. And the thing that I'm interested in discussing, because I watched the movie not as an adaptation, because I don't remember a lot about the book. I just remember certain images. But the movie taken on its own, I'm curious in a moment to talk about that and what the message of that was. You know, and that's why, Kelly, you're fired for not sitting through the whole movie, because you're going to miss out on some of this discussion. But before
that...
Well,
no, I can contribute.
But before we talk about that, though, I'm curious, what is the message of the book?
The message of the book.
Mm-hmm. Like, what's the point when you read this? What's the point of the book? Like, and here's why I'm asking is, I seem to recall, isn't the book sort of about how you are in control of your fears? The things that freak you out, that scare you as a kid, you can control them. Is that accurate? Like, do you think that's sort of the message that the kids get from the book?
You know, I really, I have to say, Tom, and I know that a lot of people will disagree with me on this, and that's fine. But I don't believe it's about that at all. I believe it's about another night in the life of a child, and it's about the mental life of a child. It's about imagination,
yeah.
Because the there's no adults in the book at all. It's all in his room. The book begins with Max just. And on this night, Max got into trouble and went to his room, essentially. And then he goes on this adventure, which is all happening in the context of his room, which becomes the world entire. And I don't believe it is about fear. And this movie seems to think that, or it seems to make the story into something about sadness and loneliness.
And it spells all that out and just puts it in the lines. Like, can you make the sadness go away? Like, everything's right there, but it's in dialogue.
Well, okay, then, so the book then, so here's another thing then, doesn't the book have, his mother is not in the book?
You don't see
No.
her.
Isn't the image of him standing up on the kitchen counter or on the dining room table with his arms folded, is that
No.
not from the book?
I don't think so.
Nope. Wow, okay.
That's, he chases the dog with a fork.
That's another thing, is there's a little dog, like, isn't there a Toto type character in the book? Doesn't he bring a little dog with him or no?
No.
He
no,
doesn't?
There's one page, yeah. There's one page with him jumping down the stairs with a fork and a dog running away, and that's it.
All right.
Yeah, but the dog doesn't go to the island, right?
No.
Yeah. And do the do you guys feel that the monsters, I mean, the monsters looked amazing in the movie.
Yeah, they
I think
did.
We can all agree on that. They were drawn very directly from the book, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, they were. Maurice Sendak said that he based them on his creepy uncles who would come to the house when he was a little child and say, "You're so cute, I want to eat you up." But he thought they were foul. And so it was done without a sentimental affection, which might make them look more wild.
So given that, Kelly, you left, so you can't really join the discussion. And Dingus, given that you didn't enjoy it as an adaptation of the book, how did you feel about it as just a standalone movie? Is something sort of inspired by the book? Did that really ruin it for you?
Well, since I've already talked about how I felt about the adaptation, Tom, I'm going to just hit that right back over the net at you and ask you the same question, because I think it's fair for you to go ahead and give us a little bit of what you thought.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything about what Tom thought of the movie. I don't know if he liked it or not. I get the sense he did, but he's not saying it.
It is very coy. And what I wished as I got into the last quarter of the movie was that I could see it exactly how Tom's describing it right now, because I was so frustrated with it as an adaptation. So I'm much more interested to hear what you have to say right now about it as maybe not what you said as an inspired work, but just as a work on its own.
So not having any of the baggage of, you know, being into the book recently, and being able to just watch it as, okay, here's something that Spike Jonze and David Eggers created. It's probably not just going to be something for children. And I was glad to see that wasn't the case. There were children in the audience when I went, And I think they were bored out of their skull. I mean, they love the monsters, but this movie is not paced like a children's movie. It's very, I think, directly paced for and tailored to adults, maybe remembering the book. But I think it's a very adult movie in a sense.
Well, Spike Jonze said he wanted to recreate, quote, the feeling of being nine again. And I walked out. So it's like that was my take on his 9-year-old memory.
Well, I think I'm not even sure it really did that.
No, it didn't.
I think like if I want to think of a movie that really gets me into the head of what it's like to be a child playing, you know, I think of something like the first half of My Neighbor Totoro, you know, the little girls moving into the new house and exploring the area. And
those movies, the Miyazaki movies, always have these awesome narrative engines, and that's what's missing from this movie.
But you know what? My Neighbor Totoro doesn't early on. My Neighbor Totoro begins with a good, I don't know, 40 minutes of just these two little girls playing. And at times, I sort of felt like Where the Wild Things Are was trying to do that, is just showing, I guess, like you were saying, Kelly, Spike Jonze being, okay, this is what it's like to be nine, is just sort of these desultory images. I mean, Kelly, you talked about the 15th music video, and I was like, yeah, this is clearly a music video director, just sort of chugging along doing, you know, okay, let's do a dirt clod fight. Now let's do the nighttime with the fires. Now let's do, the monster pile and the little discussion in the monster fort.
That just seems really repetitive to me. I mean, as a 9-year-old, I would have found that repetitive. I would have gone to, like speaking of long movies that were adapted from very short text, like basically unfilmable text, do you guys ever see this 60s movie called The Raven? It's one of those Hammer movies. And it was based on the Edgar Allan Poe poem, but it had nothing to do with the poem at all. Like Vincent Price and Peter Lorre as these two wizards, and they had like this pigeon mage duel, which had nothing to do with the poem. And they just totally – so I think it's possible to deviate from the source material and make it good, but I don't think this movie did that. So – earlier, well, I was making it sound like because it didn't resemble the book enough, I didn't like it. And that's true, too.
Right.
In addition to that.
This isn't deviation, though. This is whole cloth.
Well, but I disagree with that because, I mean, it's clearly –
the opening seems like a perfect – and I like the beginning. I like it till the Wild Things, although I liked how the Wild Things looked. But it seems like the movie loses its steam once he gets to the island and nothing happens. The Wild Things don't do anything as opposed to Vincent Price and Peter Lorre.
Kelly, I'm going to have to fire you again because you haven't seen Where It Goes. And Where It Goes ultimately – you know, I wasn't crazy about the movie. I didn't enjoy a lot of the early parts, but Where It Goes, I really appreciated. And Kelly, it's got an amazing final scene, I feel. I don't know if you would agree with me, Dingus, but I loved the final scene, the final shot, actually. And I feel that kind of redeemed it. Not entirely, but it really made it feel worthwhile to me.
Spoil it.
Well, what it reminded me most of by the time it was over was, and for a very specific reason, and I'm going to screw up these movies. So Willy Wonka is the terrible, wait, which is the Tim Burton remake? Is that Willy Wonka?
Yeah, and I watched both of these preparing for this, believe it or not. But Charlie is the Tim Burton one. Willy Wonka is the older one.
Okay, so right. Willy Wonka, the older, wait.
Charlie, but the name of the book is Charlie, so actually.
The name of the book is Charlie. The first adaptation is Willy Wonka,
okay.
And the Tim Burton is Back to Charlie.
Okay, what Willy Wonka reminded – when I think Willy Wonka is sort of this story about how terrible fathers can be in a way. There's a part in Willy Wonka where Gene Wilder becomes genuinely scary to the little boy.
Well, he's not the kid's father, though. He's not Mr. Bucket.
No, but he's a father figure. I mean, the little boy, he's sort of a strong male presence in the boy's life, and the boy doesn't really have that. And there's a point in the movie where he becomes very scary to the little boy.
Yeah, and that's not in the book either.
And that reminded me, so Where the Wild Things Are does something very similar to that with the James Gandolfini Wild Thing, which I think is sort of – and I haven't really sussed it out. Like I'm not real clear what they were going for or why they were going for it. But Where the Wild Things Are, the movie, becomes very much about a child dealing with the sort of the sadness of adults. and how that can be scary and how it can be hard to understand and how that's part of growing up. And it takes a while to get there, and it's not that concise. It's not that neat. But ultimately that's sort of what I took out of this movie and what I appreciated it for.
You know, Tom, I'm going to have to tell you that I think that's spot on. Because for me, watching both Where the Wild Things Are in a movie and the movie we're going to discuss in a little bit, I got the feeling from my perspective that I was watching movies about how not to be a crappy parent. You know, how to be a better parent, what you need to do to be a better parent. And some of what you're talking about really came through to me in this movie. There's this lovely scene there. You know, I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about as far as the very final image, but the last scene, and then there's this lovely scene early on where Max is under a desk and his mom says, okay, I could use a story.
Yes.
And he tells her a story and she types it out. And it's a beautiful scene, and I love Catherine Keener. But for me, that's a scene from another movie or another story, but I loved those two scenes. And for me as a parent, that scene and the movie we'll talk about in a little bit both made me think about specifically like sitting at my computer and when am I not being a good parent?
Yes. And the final scene, by the way, Dingus, is – Max has come back and Catherine Keener is relieved to see him, and he's sitting at the dining room table eating, and his mother is sitting there watching him, Catherine Keener, and she falls asleep. And as she falls asleep, there's this great moment, and it's an example too of how this little boy was really good. I mean, I'd like to see him deal with more challenging material. This was a lot of him goofing around and being unfettered, and that was great. And he's a gorgeous little kid. My God, those eyes. But it was that moment at the end when it's just him and Catherine Keener, and you see this sort of understanding pass over his face, where what he's gone through with the wild things, and specifically with KW and Carol, the sort of mother-father wild thing, you see crossing his face in this final scene with Catherine Keener, this sort of new appreciation for her. It just sort of emerges. It kind of comes out of his face, and it's a beautiful moment. And then the last shot is her closing her eyes and falling asleep.
And then she goes to the aisle. Right? Was that the final?
Well, let me ask you both this, Kelly and Tom. Do you think, and you're not going to be able to answer this from the point of view of the book, I don't think, but do you think that what this movie represents is a pivotal moment in his life, or this is just another night in his life?
I think it's clearly a pivotal moment in his life where he, like I said, that new understanding of his mother, he gets a new understanding of his mother. And I think contrary to what you're saying, the book was, it's not just another night in the life of a child. It's very much part of his coming of age.
And Kelly, do you think that this movie represents half an hour in the life of a child never mind.
What?
Kelly hasn't seen Where the Wild Things Are. I don't know if you know that, Dingus.
I know, because he's only seen half an hour, and that's why.
Well, in the book, his supper's still warm when he gets back from the island. So that means he hasn't been gone that long, even though he spent nights there when he's there.
Well, he spent years. It talks about him.
He should have come back as an old man. Spoiler alert.
It talks about it in the lovely poetry of the book. It talks about him sailing for I think a night and a year. I could pick it up and read it right now, but
just read a little of it because I want to show Tom what a good book it is. I'm upset at Tom for not reading the book, as he's upset at me for not.
we're a movie podcast and not a book podcast.
You know what though?
Ooh.
They are related in this case, and they were related in I Am Legend, another movie that sucked that was based on an awesome book you're an Egyptologist for, and we should do a whole podcast on that. But come on. Hey,
Can we talk about when you're watching, this wasn't an animated movie, but there were like celebrity voices. How good are you guys at spotting the celebrity voice, and how much does it distract you?
It distracts me tons, but it's in every movie, so you're inured to it by now because they've stopped using cool voice actors and just replace them with movie stars, because movie stars love to do voice because they don't have to wear makeup, they don't have to dress. It's an easy gig.
Yeah, and I kind of wish it wasn't. Like, I wish
you should do it.
Oh, good Lord. I don't.
I guess you are doing it right now. That's what this.
I only recognized James Gandolfini, and that was only like halfway through the movie. Like, I'd been listening to Carol talk for a while, going, "Oh, I know who that is. I know who that is. Oh, this is, who is that? Sounds so familiar." And then finally, I was like, "Oh yeah, James Gandolfini." But I couldn't have spotted any of the other ones. Did you
Catherine
guys?
Catherine O'Hara. Well, I knew who they were anyway, so it was
okay.
I didn't really have experience. But Michelle Williams was fired. Or not, well, politely laid off, like I was from the game, from being the voice of KW and was replaced with Lauren Ambrose of 6 Feet Under fame. Because they said her voice didn't fit the character. So
I really liked Lauren Ambrose. That was one where as I was watching the movie, I was like, oh, God, who is that? She's really good, and she's got this great quality to her. And
her Wild Thing looked kind of like her. I don't mean that in a mean way. But it was kind of red hair and kind of shuffled a lot.
Not yeah, that's very true.
But I thought it was a wise. It's a great casting.
It's better than that terrible Nine thing that Dingus and I saw with the celebrity voiceovers.
Oh, that was so painful.
You guys hated Nine?
Didn't hate it, but was disappointed. I hated the celebrity voices. I hated the voices, period, in that.
Yeah, I'm with Tom on that. Especially the generic. The generic voice that they end up with for the actual character of Nine is just so wrong.
You were okay with that, Kelly? The Nine voices?
You know, I don't try not to listen to it. Right. I was just looking at it.
You know, Tom, as an issue in general, I really hate some writer a while ago referred to it as basically the voiceover derby. You're sitting in there trying to guess first who. No. Oh, gee, that's Val Kilmer as the Pharaoh or whatever. And it's totally distracting and it annoys the hell out of me and this is, you know, part of the fact that I know so many voice actors. There are so many talented actors who can do voice. Man. You really don't need to hire. And I don't know what it does for you to get, you know, to get Patrick Stewart to do the saucer. In something, I don't know what possibly that's going to bring to you when you have so many other talented people who could do it, and I don't have to sit there the whole movie going, "Gee, who's KW? Who's KW? Who's KW?"
Well, I will confess that once I figured out that it was James Gandolfini, it actually it added because of James Gandolfini as an actor, his sort of physicality. I really liked that. I liked knowing, okay, this is James Gandolfini, and once it became clear that Carol was going to be this father figure with a temper issue, I was like, I mean, that totally worked for me. And I didn't figure anyone else out while I was watching the movie, not even Catherine O'Hara.
See, I saw him as a brother figure. Did you?
Well, Kelly, you haven't seen the movie.
I know what happens. I know what he does. I don't want to be the spoiler guy, but I know what happens. He rips off, I'll just be the spoiler. I don't care. What's somebody going to sue me? He rips off Douglas's arm, right? Isn't that this big ending?
No. Well, no, he snaps at Max and he chases him through the forest and KW. And this was just, I thought this almost sort of mythic imagery, like something from, you know, Greek mythology or something. KW has to hide Max in her mouth.
Yeah.
And talk, Carol down.
In her body, actually, not just her mouth. She ingests him.
Well, see, she says hide in my
mouth. And now I feel lame for not seeing the rest of the movie because I was actually looking forward to that one scene, but then I was hating the part I was at. So
and it's a great scene too, and they have a great dialogue. That's why you should have watched.
I know, I suck. You're right. I should be fine. I hate myself. I'm a terrible podcaster and person.
There's also probably the funniest moment of the movie right there too.
Which one?
What's funny?
When he goes into her stomach, the first thing he sees in there.
Oh, yeah, Richard. Is Richard?
Hey, Richard.
Oh.
Hi. You know, I have to say that one of the things that disturbs me about this, you know, discussion about the voiceover thing.
Did you guys recognize Forrest Whitaker, by the way?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Oh, I had no idea. Actually, so which one was Forrest Whitaker?
He was the Scientologist Wild Thing.
He was the what's the I? He was the other of Judith, the Judith's.
Oh, Ira.
He was married to Catherine O'Hara, just like in RL.
I had no idea that was him.
Yeah, I know. You wouldn't think.
So, Dingus, you were going to say one thing that disturbed you about the voiceover derby.
Well, what bothered me is just the very choice, and you know, part of this is having to go to the root of the choice of, are we going to do live action or animation for this? And one of my very basic problems of this film is that it takes everything so literally when it is based on poetry, or should be, and instead of being poetic, it becomes literal. And the use of real voices, and I have a feeling we're really going to disagree on this, Tom, the use of real voices like James Gandolfini, just being a regular human voice, really distracts me from the poetry and makes me think that we're thinking of these characters as literal symbols for things in the real world, or doppelgangers or whatever, and that's really not what it should be. And I'm not asking for some crazy, wacky monster voice, but I understand the choice, and I think it's a bold choice to go ahead and go with James Gandolfini just being James Gandolfini as a huge monster head. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it really works because of what I'm saying about the translation of the poetic to the literal.
See, I think I would disagree, Dingus, because I think that's one where you're kind of getting hung up on it as an adaptation of a poem of the book.
Yeah.
I can't get past that, though. So I agree with Dingus. I mean, it is an adaptation. I mean, it was approached as an adaptation. It's impossible to separate the book from the movie if you've read the book.
I don't see why do you say it's impossible to separate them? Like, why can't David Eggers just say, okay, here's a story from my childhood. Now I'm going to adapt it to themes that concern me as an adult.
The only reason this movie was made at all was because of the book. The only reason anyone went to see it the opening weekend, the only reason it was the number one movie is because it's this classic book, which, by the way, wasn't well-liked upon its initial reception, but then it grew and it became a bestseller and people liked it eventually.
Right, but people, Kelly, can still read the book if they want to. A movie doesn't have to be a faithful translation or a transliteration of the book.
Can it be, especially in this case, but if you've read the book, I'm just saying it's hard to separate them.
Okay. Well, you were saying before it's impossible. Now you're saying it's hard. So I feel like that's a victory for
me. It's between hard and possible. Yeah, you won.
I mean, I understand what you guys are saying, but I have never, I really enjoy when people take source material and do something unexpected or different with it. For instance, this guy, I'm not going to be able to say his name. Kelly, I'll bet you can say this guy's name. What's the name of the guy that directed Day Watch and Night Watch? That Russian guy he did.
Oh, Bekmambetov or something.
Say it again. What is it?
Timur Bekmambetov.
Very good. I think you did it. That sounds right. Dingus, can you do it?
Krzysztof Kieslowski.
Just wrong. So I was elated to hear that he, and I don't know where this is, that he was going to do an adaptation of Moby Dick. I love Moby Dick. I think Moby Dick is a beautiful book. It's one of my favorite bits of, you know, literature.
Me too.
And I'm more than happy to see someone like this goofball, who's obviously comes from a background of comic books and video games and The Matrix and Star Wars, you know, all that stuff. You know, he's totally a nerd who's into this sort of geekery. And I'm more than happy to see him do a take on Moby Dick. And it doesn't have to be faithful to the book. He can go in whatever direction he wants. Or Troy, for instance. You know, I love the Iliad. Yeah. And I'm happy to see Wolfgang Peterson cast Brad Pitt as Achilles and just sort of goof around and say, hey, here, look at this. Woo!
Brad Pitt Achilles was supposed to be a big hero, and what I've read about the Moby Dick movie is that they want to make Ahab a Brad Pitt-esque Achilles-like figure, which to me is a terrible translation of the book, which you would then.
But see, that's the thing. It's right.
No, Ahab, you're gonna mess with. You're gonna redo King Lear, but then it's.
These plays and books still exist. If you want to read those, you can go read.
I just don't want to see that. I don't want to see that movie. It's like with Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, and they want to do spinoffs. The Shia LaBeouf character. I don't want to see that.
You don't have to see that. That's kind of, nobody wants to see that.
That's he's playing Captain Ahab. So
Shia LaBeouf is not playing Captain Ahab in the Timur Bekmambetov.
IMDb comment pages.
Okay, in that case, I take back everything I said.
See? Ah, hard versus impossible.
But that's a Shia LaBeouf issue and not an issue of literary adaptation, though. But anyway, my point is that I am totally okay with source material being disregarded and instead a director and a writer bringing to the table, these are the issues that come up when I think of this source material. So rather than simply do a transliteration of it from, you know, a book to film, I'm going to tell a new story and just appropriate that's inspired by this source material. And that's clearly what happened with Where the Wild Things Are.
You know, Tom, I would agree with – I agree with that in certain situations. For instance, I'm perfectly happy if the Coen brothers want to take the Odyssey and make it into O Brother, Where Art Thou? That's fine with me because they've called it something else and they've made it their own. It's clearly inspired. It's their own thing and they're telling their own story and they're playing with it. That's fine with me. But they did not call it the Odyssey. They called it O Brother, Where Art Thou? And they made their own thing and we all knew, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, what they were doing. What they did with this was make Where the Wild Things Are, but they didn't do that. They just wrote in on the coattails of the title because that would make them money, as Kelly said earlier, instead of calling it Monsters with Big Heads Who Should Be in Therapy. And they wrote in on those coattails, and those are two different things.
Okay.
See, I would rather have seen that Matrix approach applied to this movie even than this. Because a 9-year-old craves adventure and like there's this island with giant dogs on it, and if you're gonna expand it to 90 minutes, you have this awesome island and I don't know. I mean, that's the cliche dumb way to go, but I'd rather watch that.
So here's one problem I had with this island. The monsters looked amazing. So the monsters were animatronic with CG faces. Is that correct? That's my theory about what was
going on. They were guys in suits.
Right, but they
couldn't
have...
You're right about the faces, Tom. Yeah, you're right.
Okay, yeah, because those faces were just so amazing. Yeah. I was like, that couldn't have been animatronic. So for how amazing these creatures looked, I was kind of disappointed with the actual island. It looked like they shot it in the bottom of a strip mine or something. You know, the forest bits looked good at times. And, you know, they had that sort of generic Sahara Desert set that they would cross on a couple of occasions. But I was a little disappointed in where they shot and how the actual location looked. Am I amiss there? Like, is that not a big deal?
No. You're not amiss. I mean, they go to a desert, and then that's all there is on the island.
Yeah, and then the rest of it's
not that good.
It seemed like an abandoned lot or something. Like they shot in the behind somebody's house. I was a little disappointed in that. I mean,
and then they make a big ball of twine and put it in the desert, and then that's their awesome brown on brown visual.
And so that is not from the books, I take it, because I mean, didn't the books had like lush scenery and locations, didn't they?
It was ambiguous space. You couldn't really tell how big the woods were or whether it was all taking place. Maybe Dingus remembers this better than I do. But I just remember it being taking place in sort of a clearing in the woods about the size of a cricket field. I know you guys are into the cricket.
Well, but I mean,
getting back to Tom's correct point, but like how would you film like Infinite Jest, which I know Tom didn't read. Any David Foster Wallace novel, for example, like that would be impossible to do without completely changing the concept somehow to make it even just fit the length, let alone get even a trick. Like some authors are just basically unfilmable.
It's sort of an unfair comparison, but Kelly, have you seen a movie called The Cell?
Yeah, the Jennifer Lopez one.
Good.
Oh, no. What's not The Cell? What's the one with the little girl?
The Fall.
The Fall. Good Lord. Yeah, so the director of The Cell also did a movie called The Fall, and the idea behind The Fall is this is a story that's spun out inside of a little girl's mind, and he shoots, and he doesn't use any CG. It's all like practical stuff shot on location, and it just does an amazing job of creating these vivid, colorful, impossible-looking places. And so while I was watching Where the Wild Things Are, I was thinking, how awesome would it be to have these gorgeous creatures in locations like appeared in The Fall?
Or anything that's somehow psychologically textured, like woods or forest. Like, if you just go, if there's a giant desert on the island, what's that say about Max's id? Like, that most of his brain is a desert, and there's this one tiny nodule on the corpus callosum where the wild things are.
Yeah. Well, there's even a desert moment or moments in The Fall, and when I think about that, I'm stunned by the colors in my head because of what he did with contrast there. And there's none of that in this movie. It feels barren. And it was filmed somewhere in Australia, and they even, I think, tried to take some of the color out of it. Whereas the book has a lot of color and seems fairly lush to me as I remember the pictures. And I think it needed some of what Tom is talking about from The Fall, some almost hyper-realistic but still real.
Good Lord, picture. Why would they take color out? That just seems insane.
Where'd you read that? That's interesting.
I don't know, and I could be totally wrong about that, but it seemed like they tried to brown
it. What surprised me?
Well, yeah, I was going to say that makes sense, but I just thought it's because they only had permission to shoot at the bottom of the strip mine. Like, I can't imagine that they intentionally went for that brown look.
But they could have even had awesome exotic geography just out of brown if they want to. Like that, the thing he has in his workshop, that little miniature city. Like,
yes,
that could have been an actual city on the island that they could have gone to. I don't know.
And that moment I loved. Like, that was a point where I was like, wow, the production design in this is amazing. And then there was the rest of the movie.
And it was a very original. It was just like, out of nowhere, he takes him to this place. And it was cool to see that one prop, actually.
So actually, you made it to that part, Kelly. Congratulations.
Yeah, well, that was the hump. But now I do feel remorse, and I feel like I suck.
Okay, well, as long as you feel remorse, that's an important
step. If that helps.
Maybe next time that we all agree to see a movie, you'll actually watch it. So here's, I think you did do this part of the homework, Kelly. Before we even saw Where the Wild Things Are, I was going to be curious how it related to another movie that I'd seen earlier this year, which I adore. I'm curious if you guys also see connections. So Dingus, I know you have seen Coraline. Kelly Wand, have you seen Coraline?
I did. I loved Coraline, and I felt really bad that I didn't see it in the theater after having seen it, because I thought it was great.
Yes.
It was Selleck's best movie by far. It was better than Nightmare Before Christmas by far. It was just a great adaptation as well, and it tapped into our universal fears of Terry Hatcher, which I thought was a nice detail.
Last week is San Diego, this week is
And now, how do you guys feel about Coraline in comparison to Where the Wild Things Are?
Has his narrative thread and a story and stuff going on, and I would say more psychological depth than Where the Wild Things Are.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be read either as in her head or not, whereas I think Wild Things, like Dingus was saying, does make the poetic literal, and Coraline keeps it a little vaguer. I was thinking, oh, never mind, it's a spoiler.
Well, but we can spoil, actually, we'll say that this podcast is only for people who have seen Where the Wild Things Are and Coraline now.
And how many people's that? I just asked, probably.
Coraline did pretty well. I think
did it?
I think
okay.
Did well enough, yeah. And the kind of people who would go see Where the Wild Things Are, probably the kinds of people who saw Coraline, who know who Neil Gaiman, or no. Oh, Coraline is actually Alan Moore, isn't it?
No, it's Neil Gaiman. You're
no,
right.
It's
you're
an right. Alan Moore comic book, I believe.
No, you're baked. It's a novel by Neil Gaiman.
I have read Coraline, and I have seen the movie a few times. Yeah, so
you have not.
I didn't. I have. Yes, I.
You read the book.
Yes, I did. I liked the movie so much, and I was so curious about what Henry Selick did differently from the book, what parts were his, what parts were Neil Gaiman's, that I went to the library and I got the book and I read it in one sitting. I mean, you know, it's a short book, but so I am equipped to talk about both the book and the movie and how they differ and
One way they differ is the movie introduces the character of Wybie,
right?
The annoying neighbor kid, although he's not annoying. And he's Roger Ebert's review. I don't know if you guys read it of Coraline. He said that his problem with the movie was that Coraline was such an unlikable character that she deserved all I thought she was a great character.
Yeah, if you want to know an unlikable character, let me tell you about an unlikable character. That Roger Ebert fella.
No, he slapped the guy with the newspaper.
That was perfect. Coraline is not unlikable. That's horrible.
I know. She's great. She's kind of a dick to her dad because he's working at the beginning and he is ignoring her.
Well, the arc of Coraline, and it's why I think so before I saw Where the Wild Things Are, and I hadn't read the book in a while, and I vaguely recalled, I think that book was something about how your fears and your fantasies are something that you can control, that you can tame. You know, you can be the boss of the monsters, and you can then send them to bed without dinner. And So I was a little bit off, I imagine. But whereas Coraline, which I had recently seen, I felt the message of that was your fantasies and your ideals can be dangerous. They can get out of hand, and sometimes you should appreciate and be happy with what's real,
even if it's lame.
And it's probably not as lame as you think it is.
Lame. Never mind.
Well, so I sort of saw these contrasting messages, and that was what I remembered of the book and what I had just seen of Coraline. But now that I have seen Where the Wild Things Are, the movie, I feel that it actually does more closely relate to Coraline than I suspected it would when I was just vaguely recalling the book. They're both sort of about, how the real and the fantastic diverge and what you can learn about them from each other. What a visit, you take a visit to the fantastic, and then when you return to the real, you have a newfound appreciation for it. That seems to me the point of both Coraline, the movie, and Where the Wild Things Are, the movie.
I am not sure. First off, I don't look as closely for messages as you do when I go to the movies, which maybe is just, a subjective thing. Like, I just look for the story and, like, what would happen if I went through the door to the button eye world.
Well, and also you leave halfway through, so that's a little difficult to...
And Christian sees these movies as a parent, like he's saying, "Oh yeah, this will make me a better parent. If I'm the mom without the button eyes, then that'll be better for my child." Well, as I see it as from the kid's point of view, because I'm, a 9-year-old basically. But
except you thought she was being a dick to the father who was trying to do some writing.
Well, she turns off the power when she doesn't really need to. She hits the switch. I guess she didn't.
That's an accident.
Yeah, it's a kid thing.
But then she hears him sob with despair, and then she kind of shrugs, like, "Eh, whatever, dude. I don't care about our supper, your salad."
At the throwaway gag, and you're turning Coraline into an unlikable sadist because of something you read from Roger Ebert.
No, just that one thing. And she's a little bitchy to YB too, because he doesn't talk that much.
But see, the point is, Kelly.
Wrong. You wouldn't say that a boy was being bitchy if a boy was being
no. Bitchy. Her bitchiness is thing. Winds up being
she's not being bitchy. She's just being strong.
How dare you, Kelly?
I'm sorry.
Sexist.
Yeah. What?
You know, Tom. Just I think what you just said was interesting because I think you're right. About the controlling of fantasy and the controlling of imagination, because there's this feeling in the book Where the Wild Things Are that Max is in control of everything. I mean, he gets to the island. He's not afraid of these creatures. He's the king. He stares them in the eye. He runs everything. And I also like talking about it from a movie perspective about how going to the fantasy and coming back from that and having learned something, I think that's interesting as well. What threw me off, having seen Coraline before going to see the movie Where the Wild Things Are, is I kept thinking of Carol and KW and Judith as having corollaries to Max's real world, and wondering, well, wait, who's that supposed to be? Is that supposed to be his mom? And wait, is that supposed to be his dad that we haven't seen? Wait, is that supposed to be Claudia, his sister, or what, Claire, whatever her name is? Is that supposed to be? And I kept trying to match them up, and I don't think you're supposed to do that.
I don't think so either, because who would Judith and Ira be? Like, they're a married couple, and the woman wants to eat Max instantly. Like, that's – who's that?
Or not, you know. Other
are
than
they the neighbors?
other than that idiotic scene with the stupid science teacher, you don't really have any other adults. So I don't know.
Why do you Why do you think that was an idiotic scene?
If you make that scene into something, and you know, if you make that scene into something that is clearly this is how Max is filtering the world, this isn't what really goes on. That's fine. But no teacher talks like that. That's ridiculous.
It's, so you're saying it's not realistic?
No, I wanted to punch Spike Jonze. Because that's the typical sort of Hollywood. We're going to have an idiotic teacher doing something no teacher ever does, and I wanted to punch him for that.
Well, he's supposed to be, classic. I think, a science teacher, and he's not really saying anything scientific after the sun. He goes, oh, it's just a tidal wave. He's talking about 2012, basically.
He's just scaring a bunch of kids, which they don't, you know, it's like
And he's kind of smiling while he does it, like, oh, you guys are so screwed.
If this is a scene that Max, that you know, it's – everybody else is hearing what the teacher's actually saying, but that's what Max is hearing, right? Then that's cool. But if this is this guy actually telling all these kids that the sun's going to go out and he's like all excited about it, I didn't buy it.
Well, very clearly, I just want to say part of why I liked that scene, but I think clearly what that scene was David Eggers remembering when he first learned that the sun was going to burn out one day. And I remember that too. I remember hearing that as a kid and thinking, well, what? No.
I don't think
it's supposed to be like realistic or magic. I mean, I think it was just David Eggers saying, hey, I remember finding out that the sun's going to burn out, let's put that in the movie in some capacity, because this
right,
is a movie.
Right,
that's
right.
What a 9-year-old would obsess over.
Oh, I agree, but I just think it's self-indulgent rather than thinking it's amusing.
Well, when I heard the news as a kid, it was a news story that the sun was going to burn out in a few hundred billion years or something. I thought, oh, cool, we'll just go somewhere else. So I wasn't even, you know.
Ah.
And, you know, infinity.
But anyway, so I cut you off, Dingus. That was an aside you were saying.
No. I was finished with that. I was just saying that one of the things that threw me off was the whole corollary thing, which is clearly not what I was supposed to get out of Where the Wild Things Are.
Ah, right.
That's because you had too much time on your hands and you had time to think about stuff like that. Because the Wild Things weren't doing anything except having parties to indie rock.
Oh my God, the soundtrack I did not care for.
No, and it just kept going.
It was like indie chick rock stuff, and I was like, what am I watching Juno?
No, and it constantly, to me, it felt like this weird, surreal insurance commercial or some strange commercial.
Yeah.
I just couldn't get it at all. Can I say something about Coraline now?
Well, only if you pronounce her name correctly.
Yeah, she has an issue with that.
Yeah, I know. I love that, too.
Yeah.
I found, and I'm not doing this on purpose, but I found it so fascinating to watch this movie after having watched Paranormal Activity, because I saw things that related to the two of those movies a lot, and that made me pretty excited, actually.
They're both houses with evil creatures living in them.
Well, there's a female.
There's also
sort of a Pan's Labyrinth thing going on, but there's this weird sort of reaching through and trying to cross over quality, and also sort of a sleep activated kind of a thing going on that I loved. Because she goes to sleep, and that's when the door first opens for her, I think. And at that point, you're not sure, at least I wasn't sure, is this dream? Are we supposed to assume this is dream? Is this within the world of sleep or without the world of sleep? And when she's going to sleep, and I'm getting this whole sort of Paranormal Activity when she first is going to sleep, and I just really enjoyed that aspect of it.
Yeah, it was creepy, huh?
In a very good way.
Yeah.
And it did have a camera.
Action
with the little boy's camera taking pictures. So there you go.
Right.
The little boy's camera actually reminded me of those twins in Nine.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, with the little projector eyes. That was the one cool part. That was probably my favorite cool part of Nine.
You're right about that, Tom.
I thought it was a terrible idea of Coraline's to put the key and the evil queen's severed hand together down the spooky ancient well because wells are where monsters live, and maybe the other mommy has, like,
well,
friends.
Well, we'll get a sequel then.
Uh-huh. But that's how she disposes of it. Sorry.
The well was, is the well in the book? Yeah, the well is in the book.
You actually read the book. That's pretty impressive.
I did read. Well, and the cool thing too is in the book, because YB isn't there to like help her fight the hand at the well, in the book, she does this great trick where she uses her dolls as a she lays them out on a blanket like they're having a tea party over the opening of the well. And then the hand goes out onto the tea party, I think, where the key is, and then falls down the well. Like, she lays a trap using the well, all of her dolls having a tea party.
Oh, that's good.
Basically using her, you know, like leaving her toys behind. It's sort of like the final stage of growing up is, you know, I'm you know, passing my toys are sort of thrown down the well with the, you know, the witch and the key.
Yeah. And the key represents her.
You know what? I don't even think I want it. Like, I liked Coraline so much. I don't think I want to analyze Coraline.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I meant earlier. And I really try to go in as dumb as possible to any movie. And then I talk about it as dumb as possible.
And then come out as dumb as possible as well. That's
so far.
I mean, that just where Coraline's so, you know, it's such a great variation on that Alice in Wonderland thing. And it's just, and Pan's Labyrinth. I mean, there's, yeah, it's.
I love Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
Best movie.
So
that's what I think that there's just that literal, you get that literal image of the drawing of the door, and it happens actually even in Where the Wild Things Are, now that I think about it. But it's sort of an inescapable image for those two movies, especially since you're dealing with two little girls.
Wait, what's the drawing of the door thing you're talking about, Dingus?
From Pan's Labyrinth, and then her finding the door, and I think, I don't know if it's the father or the mother who has to cut it out of the plaster or out of the paint in Coraline.
Right, but you said in where there's no door in Where the Wild Things Are, though.
Yeah, and there's a moment when he's in the giant ball of twine, to quote Kelly, where he's making a little door because he wants a secret place only for himself.
Ah, very
and
good.
You see him actually trying to carve a door, and Carol says, "What are you doing?"
Right.
You remember what I'm saying?
Yep. Yeah.
So that image of the door, that little door, is sort of specific to these two movies, to Coraline and Pan's Labyrinth. And then I just threw that in from Where the Wild Things Are just now.
Oh, good. So I think we all agree that Coraline is better than Where the Wild Things Are. Is that correct?
Easily.
Okay.
Oh, yes. And let me ask both of you this then, and I don't know if you care to answer it, but do you think that Where the Wild Things Are should have been live action or should have been animated, or do you even care?
That is a good question. It's a real, I appreciated the technical wizardry of it being live action, and I also appreciated having Max Records, you know, the kid playing Max, having how expressive he was and watching him. And I think, too, Spike Jonze is just so good with that, you know, that sort of handheld style and, you know, obviously with issues of lighting. So I was glad it was live action.
Yeah.
You had wished it was animated, Dingus?
I don't necessarily feel the way. It was hard for me because I thought the animation in Coraline was so beautiful, and I was so taken with the way, because I did listen to the commentary is it Henry Selick? Is that his name?
Yep.
Yeah.
Does, and I was so taken with the way he talked about that process and how gracious he is to everyone who worked on the film, and how he describes animators as actors, as having done performances. And I was so taken with that whole process and how alive that movie seemed and how much I bought into that world, so much more than the world of Where the Wild Things Are. And given my contention that the movie makes it too literal for me, instead of a painting or a poem, I wonder if animation could have solved that. Even something as simple as the kind of animation, not simple, that's the wrong word, but the kind of animation you see in Beowulf or the animation that you see in Coraline, I wonder if that would have worked more for me.
Right. They certainly could have done a lot more with the locations. That's for sure.
I think it could have been live action, but it should have been 10 minutes long. Like the book.
Kelly,
that would have been my vote.
Kelly, you haven't even seen the movie. When you've
I
seen
saw more
it,
than 10 minutes.
When you've seen Where the Wild Things Are,
do another podcast.
Come back and we'll, yeah. Yeah. So let's do our new feature. Are we ready for this?
Are we done with Coraline?
We could do a whole episode on Coraline. I mean, yeah. I was just sort of curious how Coraline related to Where the Wild Things Are. And I think it's just sort of a, in a nutshell, I feel that they're both have very similar messages. And Coraline just sort of is firing on all cylinders, whereas Where the Wild Things Are is a bit more erratic.
Well, because it's not just a message, Coraline. It's a story.
It's a story, and I feel Neil Gaiman was definitely doing, like you said, Kelly, much more of a conventional narrative. You know, the book Where the Wild Things Are is an illustrated poem for all intents and purposes, but there is so much sort of verbal and narrative wizardry in Coraline. Like I was thinking, there's really nothing like this in the movie version of Where the Wild Things Are. The language for the two names of the villain in Coraline, Other Mother is what she's known as at first, and that just sounds, that has this great ring to it, and it sounds so innocuous. But
it's sinister. It's,
yeah, when you parse it, it's a little sinister, and I just love the sound of that, Other Mother. But then her real name is the Beldam, which it's a beautiful word for its, for one thing, you know, it could mean like a beautiful woman, a Beldam, but then you hear that word and you think of Bedlam.
Yeah.
And Bedlam of itself is a beautiful word because it's two words. It's made of two words that mean the exact opposite of what it is. You know, a bed and a lamb are both tranquil and peaceful, but you put them together, Bedlam, and it's chaos. Like there's this beautiful verbal wizardry there that the movie knows and the movie appreciates.
And Nell Dame is a mad woman, by the way.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So yeah, that's what I thought the name was. How's the name spelled in the book? Is it it's a name?
Beldam. Isn't
it? I thought it was supposed to, I thought she was saying what Kelly just said.
Beldame?
Yeah.
Like Belle.
That's what I thought too. Tom just made it,
no, no, no. In the book, she's Beldam. She's the Beldam.
Oh, how fascinating.
Yeah.
Hey,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to freak out, but that's...
Oh, I thought you were being sarcastic.
No. That's actually really interesting, because in my head I was seeing Beldam.
Hey, in the book, in the movie she gets the seeing device that helps her find the two objects she needs,
right?
To orphan eyes, ghost eyes. She gets them from those two old whores by when they stab a hard candy with knitting needles.
Right.
Does that happen in the book? Because that seemed very arbitrary, although I didn't dislike it, but it seemed very odd that they were the ones who had this device and would give it to her. As
you know,
opposed
I've,
to crazy Russian guy who's psychic, or Wybie's grandma whose sister disappeared.
I forget if the little video game device, if the little, you know, heads-up display is in the book or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
No,
so,
that,
by the way, what an amazing movie to watch on Blu-ray. I just have to say.
Nerd alert.
So, Tom, were you going somewhere with, as far as the names were concerned, as contrasted with
Are? So, in Where the Wild Things Are, you know, they were named, you know, Douglas.
Right, and Carol. And Chris Cooper.
I asked Spike Jonze what those names meant, and he said, it wouldn't mean anything to you.
That's what I wondered about. Is he,
spoiler alert.
Good Lord.
It's an anagram.
Yeah. But they're different names from the ones assigned to the dolls that existed for the book before the movie was being produced. Like, they had all these different names for the dolls, like QB or something.
Oh, goodness.
But they're not named in the book, right?
No, and they don't talk. And that's that to me.
No way! They do not talk in the book?
No.
Oh.
No. Well, they do say things, but not as individuals.
How do they say things?
Well, you have, I mean, the last thing that KW, is it?
Yeah.
The last thing that KW says to him is a quote from the book, the Wild Things Say That. The, what's her quote? Please don't go, I'll eat you up.
Please don't go, I love you so, I eat you up. Or yeah,
Yeah, but it's a group quote. It's just, they said, the Wild Things cried. So I don't think any of them actually, it's not any of them actually talk. But that is a quota of the Wild Thing.
Dingus, what is that quote? Look that up, because I do remember that in the movie, that being this rare, beautiful verbal moment that was missing, because so much of the movie is just naturalistic dialogue. And then she comes out with that beautiful little line. What was that?
All right, hold on.
Okay.
Stand
just
by.
Read the whole book to us, which should be. You know,
yeah,
seconds.
We could have done that. All right, here we are. But the wild things cried, "Oh, please don't go. We'll eat you up. We love you so."
That's
see, listen,
great.
It's, isn't that? And the whole book's like that.
Kelly, you wouldn't know because you didn't see that part of the movie. Hello, you haven't even seen the movie. You missed that part.
I know what happened.
And here's the thing, and this is how you know. This is why it's totally different. What happens right after that is, and Max said no, and the wild things roared their terrible roars and gnashed their terrible teeth, and roared their terrible eyes and showed their terrible claws. So it's a completely different idea there.
Yeah, there's this sad keening when they leave it when he leaves at the end. Wow,
like that which sound your really cat just made in the background,
which was really quite lovely. I mean, you know, I was expecting the whole James Gandolfini doing the ending of Manhattan or When Harry Met Sally and running to say goodbye, but the keening was pretty lovely. But that's not the book. Yeah,
yeah.
Which Tom doesn't mind because he didn't read the book.
That's right.
Tom has time to read a whole Neil Gaiman novel. But
even if he had read the book, though, Tom wouldn't mind because he doesn't mind if they, you know, bastardize.
They totally change it, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
He's a bastardization apologist.
Exactly.
Well, I respect that.
All right, well, you guys know what time it is?
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between. Counting 1, 2, 3, feet apart and they're free, getting down with 3 the feet, everybody loves old.
That's your cue, Dingus.
A plus, Tom. Totally makes up for the other thing, the other music.
Come on, wasn't that awesome?
That was awesome. The other music's terrible.
Can a podcast jump the shark? Is that possible?
Oh, that ship's sailed.
All right, now we have entered the drawing of the three. All right, this is our new feature, 3x3, wherein we come up with a list. Someone proposes a list each week, and we all come up with three films that fulfill that list, and preferably those three films, which we will divulge in order of 3, 2, 1 individually, are conceptual ideas, not simply three movies I really like this year or three movies with hot babes in them, but three movies that, for instance, this week, Tom.
So this week, our three movies are going to be three movies that I really liked this year.
What?
Oh, fired. No, that's right. That wasn't a good one. So this week, actually, Dingus, you sort of inspired this week's topic when we were talking about Paranormal Activity, and you said the ending ruined the movie for you, and it didn't really. You sort of clarified that. But I proposed, what are three movies, come up with three movies where the ending kind of ruined the movie for you. And I realized that as I was trying to think of this, I realized that's kind of tough to come up with. And I might have screwed up on my own list, but I have three here. And
I have five.
Two. You can only do three of them, Kelly, or else I'll have to come up with a new Britney Spears lead-in song. So here we have three. So it's my topic, so I will – you know what? I'll go last. So
wait, hold on.
Okay.
It's okay if the movies overlap.
Right.
And in this case, just say it again. It's three movies that were ruined in
three movies that were ruined by the ending.
By the ending, okay.
Yeah. All right, so to start us off, Kelly, why don't you start us off with your number three?
Okay, my number three, and just to clarify, these are movies that were actually spoiled by the ending, not just bad endings to movies, which would be a very easy list. But
right.
Like movies where the ending was so bad it undid all the good work that had been done for an hour and 30 minutes.
Good. If you can come up with those, that's awesome. I'm not sure I succeeded on that front. But Kelly, what's your third one? Go for it.
My number three is King Kong, the Peter Jackson one, with Jack Black saying, "'Twas beauty for the beast."
Oh, ooh. Wow. That's a good one, Kelly.
Very, very nice. Yes.
Very good. All right. Dingus, what's your number? No.
Oh,
now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
Yeah. So now, Dingus, what's your number three?
My number three would be the film Sunshine, which was a great movie until it became a wacky serial killer movie.
I agree with you.
Oh, so we're just doing movies then where you didn't understand the ending? Is that?
No.
Exactly. It's movies where I didn't understand Jack Black's ending, like Kelly said.
I was puzzled.
I thought he was
I thought he was actually that character.
Okay, well, my number three, and I might have screwed this up. Maybe you guys should just do your lists. My number three is Murder on the Orient Express.
Which one? Yeah, Albert.
You're like the last. The last word in the title.
Because Tom didn't like whodunit because it wasn't.
Well, that's the thing is if you have a mystery, like so many movies, like they have a mystery and then the ending of the movie is, okay, you resolve the mystery. And a lot of movies. So here's what I did with my three movies. I've got categories of how you can screw up a movie with the ending. And one way you can do it is with a crappy resolution to your mystery. Is copping out. And in Murder on the Orient Express, I'm going to go ahead and spoil this because nobody's going to see this movie. It's from like 1970 or something. At the end of the movie, it turns out that all the suspects are guilty. They all killed the dude. They all basically took turns like stabbing the victim or whatever. I don't even remember. But
it should have been Hercule Poirot. Like he should have been the killer. And that's the
Well, he's the only guy that wasn't involved, yeah. So that's an example of movies where they really cheese out and they sort of betray the hard work they've done with a cheesy ending.
Because
so
you can't guess that. It's unguessable.
Right. You would never guess that, exactly. All right. So your number two, Kelly Wand.
I Am Legend with Will Smith. When the woman and the kid drove out on one of the bridges that we saw detonated earlier in the movie, and they drove to a community in Vermont, which means Will Smith wasn't the last man on Earth, so it's not a last man on Earth movie, is it?
All right. Okay, that's good. Kind of, you know, and you feel that that impacted your enjoyment?
I was hating it before that, so it probably should be on the list, but that made me go, I can never watch this again.
Okay.
It's completely unacceptable. They've trashed everything that they had.
Fair enough. So it also meant that the tagline was correct, though, because isn't the tagline on that movie, the last man on Earth is not alone?
Alone, right.
So there you go.
He wasn't alone before the virus either, so he could have been the last man on Earth who wasn't alone before anyone died, and that phrase would still be correct.
Well, then he wasn't the last man on...
I'm the last man on Earth, except for everyone else on Earth. That's what the I Am Legend is looking
at. Okay, all right.
Which end it should have been.
All right.
You like that movie, so...
Was that faithful to the book, the ending?
No.
All right.
The ending of the book is... Oh, never mind. It's a great book, and it's basically he really is the last man on Earth. And he is legend because the vampires... See well, him as their.
All right, I've seen the actual I Am Legend movie, the original one.
Yeah, it wasn't. What do you mean?
With Vincent
Mega
Price.
Man?
No, Vincent Price.
Well, okay. In the book, there's the girl. He hooks up with a girl, but she turns out to be one of them, and she's wearing fake skin, and that's.
Well, that's in the movie too, in the original, in the Vincent Price movie, kind of. Also,
but not in the Will Smith one.
Right.
So I'm outraged.
Okay. Good.
Glad we got that out of my system.
Dingus, what's your number two?
Hate my list.
No, your list is good. You're doing good.
I believe that's called Last Man on Earth, by the way.
Yeah.
I Am Legend made my short list, I would have to say. Not for the reason because of the detonated bridge, just because he didn't turn out to be the villain, which I think is a lovely twist.
And makes the title actually mean something at all, as
right.
opposed to what it does mean.
Right. So my number two would be, and I hope Gordon Cameron is listening to this podcast because number two is the space epic 2001.
Oh, you did that just to piss with me. You knew I would go. How dare you?
I am pissing with you, as you say.
No one's ever said that.
I think it's 3.5 hours of flying through the phantasmagoric space.
See, it sounds like you hated the whole movie, so it shouldn't be on this list.
No,
I think you're
really,
cheating.
I give this movie a chance every couple of years. I even went to the Cinerama Dome to see it in a theater once, just to see. I'll just see it in a movie theater.
Right.
And that the last minutes are just internally self-indulgent and make me want to scream and claw my eyes out.
See, that's how what you just said makes me feel. That's one of the greatest movies ever made. How dare you?
Exactly.
Now I got to find what you like and just put it on.
That's a good one. Your, I guess I like that.
Make your number one Rushmore and you'll be fine.
Oh, you hate Rushmore?
No, I love Rushmore, oh. So make that your number one.
Right. I forgot what I just said. Spoiler alert.
So my number two for a movie that was ruined by its ending, this is a little disingenuous because I don't believe this. But a friend of mine believes this, so I'm going to sort of be his proxy. And I'm going to put this in here because he feels this way. So standing in for me, this is the opinion of a friend of mine named Jeff. Jeff would pick The Usual Suspects. Because here's an example of a it was all a dream ending kind of thing. But it's kind of a variation on that.
That's the only good part of the movie, though, I would say.
Kind of what?
That's the best part, as you find out.
Well, exactly. That's sort of the twist. And what happens is at the end of the movie, everything you've seen is recast, has to be reinterpreted based on something that you see at the very ending. And I liked that, and I really like Usual Suspects, but my friend Jeff he hates the movie because of that, because he felt cheated. And sometimes you can take something, you can make that work. Like, I don't think he minds that with, for instance, Fight Club. But sometimes it's a cheat.
That's how I felt by Vanilla Sky. Like, it's just a cryogenic dream.
There you go, yeah. Or No Way Out, that thing with...
Yeah, you know what? That was on my list. Now I can take it off. Good.
or Jacob's Ladder, for that matter, which was almost...
Yeah. Good one.
All right, so your number one movie that was ruined by the ending, Kelly Wand, what's yours?
Unbreakable.
Yeah, because
I said that last week, so maybe I should say something else.
Kind of a spoiler, but no, so explain why Unbreakable.
Unbreakable, it somehow makes it plausible that Bruce Willis is a guy in his 40s who hasn't noticed that he can't be hurt, has never gotten sick, and somehow buy into that. And the twist of the ending, which isn't a bad twist necessarily, is that Samuel Jackson, who gets hurt just by doing nothing constantly, he's like his polar opposite, so he's evil and black. I think there's something else going on there, but it's just a crappy confrontation. Like, you find out he's the guy who killed all those people, trying to find his polar opposite, who was Bruce Willis, the hero. But he purposely reveals that information by taking his glove off and shaking Bruce Willis's hand, and that's how that information's conveyed to the Bruce Willis character, whose name escapes me. And then you just find out in text that he's confined to an asylum, and I hate that text. It's just like, all right, so there was some legal case. You don't need to know about it. All you need to know is that he lifted some weights. Nothing else that happened matters. And I guess that's supposed to be leading for a sequel? Okay. But if so, that's a terrible cliffhanger. Text? I don't go to movies to see text.
And so that impacted your enjoyment of the rest of the movie?
It made me think other things that I was giving a free pass to, him being, like water being, what's M. Night Shyamalan's thing with water? It's like, it's what kills the aliens in Signs, and it kills Bruce Willis in Unbreakable, and, it's responsible for photosynthesis and The Happening. I think you see my point.
Very good.
There's that movie Lady in the, what was it?
Oh yeah. What was it?
Yeah, Lady in the Lake, another water. But we're mostly made of water. So if Bruce Willis is, his vulnerability is water, then he should, you know what I'm saying? Like, the human body is mostly water. The earth is mostly water. He's not made of sand.
That's a good point.
Thank you very much.
All right, so good. So those are your three movies that were ruined by the ending.
People aren't paying money for this, are they?
Yeah, there will be a PayPal button you can press. All right, Dingus, what is your number one movie ruined by the ending?
My number one movie ruined by the last, specifically the last couple of minutes, is a movie called Presumed Innocent.
What?
Oh, that's a good ending. What are you talking about? The one with Harrison Ford?
Is there the Roman Polanski thing?
No.
Oh, good
what
Lord.
Are you talking about? What?
That's frantic.
No, that's real life.
Presumed Innocent is a movie based on a book by Scott Turow, and it's basically sort of a murder mystery, a courtroom thriller. And the reason the very ending, I had read the book, so I knew what was going on. And it's a great little thriller, head and shoulders above any of those idiotic Grisham books. But you have the ending, you have everything basically resolved. You have this very interesting, what should be the final shot, where he finds this tool that has evidence on it. And then the woman playing his wife, Bonnie Bedelia, comes down and delivers this ridiculous monologue that seems to go on forever, but I'm sure it's only 30 seconds. But it's completely self-aware. It's a complete invention by the filmmakers. It's this weird Lady Macbeth, Ophelia, I'm crazy monologue delivered in this monotone. And it totally, for me, ruined what had gone on before. It's just the perfect example of what this category was, that this movie had been very well structured and then somebody tacked on this ridiculous monologue at the end.
So it's just the monologue you're griping about, not the actual twist that the wife was the one who killed Greta Scacchi.
No. That's the point of the story, which is fine with me. The problem with me and sort of this category, as I mentioned it before, is that last couple minutes that ruins a movie.
And it's what she actually says.
It's just her coming down and delivering this idiotic monologue that's sort of like that monologue at the end of Psycho, where it's like, this is what happened, and we are going to tell you about it.
Yeah.
It's awful.
See, Psycho would be on this list if it wasn't good before that.
Right. That movie survived.
You just block out the last 2 minutes. I'm sorry.
And in reality, I'd probably watch Presumed Innocent again and like it again.
I don't remember what she says or like what are her – like do you remember any quotes that stick out for you?
No, I just remember the general sort of hand-wringing and then – the wife would – she does it sort of in this Carl Malone third person kind of thing where she's – and then maybe a wife would collect the condom and the condom – she would collect some of what was in the condom. It was this weird – and it just had nothing to do with the rest of the movie.
And not really her character. Like she hasn't been set up as this third person talker.
No, it's total audience handholding. It's for any of us who couldn't have figured out what was going on by watching the movie.
Aren't most courtroom thrillers, though, don't they usually end with that kind of fizzle, like it's just someone – it's a flip-flop or whatever you
– I think we've been conditioned to think that because of Law & Order is on 24/7 on every channel. But I think that this particular movie was too smart for that particular ending.
What about – would you guys say Fatal Attraction is ruined by the ending?
I don't think so, but I don't remember the very, very ending.
Fatal Attraction had to have the ending was taken from basically slasher films.
Yeah. She comes out of the bathtub, right?
Yeah. It's okay.
The very ending, I think, is this is this pretty good the police show up and he's like signing something or filling out a police report and that's it.
The runner-up on my list, by the way, since I can't say it, was Sidewalk Stories, a silent movie by a guy named Charles Lane. Do you remember this?
No.
It's like a Charlie Chaplin kind of thing, but it was like 1988. And you hear – it's silent until the end, and then you hear these panhandlers at the very end. And it's the first sound you hear in the movie, and it's them going, you got change for quarter.
That's good.
Ruined.
All right, now, Tom.
My number one movie ruined by the ending, and again, this is a category of how you can ruin a movie, was the Steven Spielberg remake of War of the Worlds, which I loved that movie. I was quite fond of it. But what they do at the ending is they decide that all the terrible things that happen, or at least the ones that most impact the hero, were fake. You know, the feelings that you had thinking that he'd lost his family, his son. All of those were just for the dramatic purposes of the moment when you were in the movie. But at the end, the son is alive and he's at his parents' house. You know, he reunites with his family.
Untouched.
Yeah. So it's sort of like the movie makers are saying, hey, we know you're about to leave the theater. We don't want you to have any lingering feelings of sadness. We don't want you to be bummed out. So we are going to apply a last-minute emotional patch to the experience.
Yeah. He was totally unscathed, too. Like, if he'd even had, like, a little smudge of dirt on his face. Or he'd lost an arm, would have been my vote. But
yeah, are you sure he wasn't? Come on, he must have been like...
They were all just dressed up and just standing on the porch. It was a weird scene.
Oh, right. The son was. Right. Tom Cruise was...
And how did that son get to Boston so fast? Like, he outdistanced Cruise on foot.
I guess because he had to be there for the last-minute emotional patch applied to the movie, yeah.
I thought he was set on fire, though.
No, he got better.
Mm.
So that was our 3x3 for this week. Next week, Kelly Wand, what are you proposing for our topic for next week?
Next week is a totally different concept. I think you'll be very impressed. Movies saved by the final few minutes.
Ah.
So crappy movies that suddenly at the very end you go, you know what? Now I have to like the whole movie.
Very good. Well done, Kelly.
But it can't be good till the ending. You have to have hated the movie until
the thing. A movie that would have been, you would have forsaken it, but it was saved by the ending. Good.
Right. See, oddly, Presumed Innocent was on my list, but now I have to take it off. But you may, never mind.
And before we discuss our 3x3 next week, we will be seeing, I have to look up the name of it because it makes no sense to me. What is it? Gentleman Broncos. Which is the next movie from Jared Hess, the fellow who, in my book, he's one for one. I like Napoleon Dynamite.
He's one for two, because Nacho Libre was...
Oh, right, one for two. It's whole sports terminology. I don't really... I try to use it, and I get in trouble. So he's one for two, yeah. So
Said there'd be math on this.
I didn't know there would be math or sports references.
So we can't do Serious Man, the new Coen Brothers movie? Which I saw... just before Where the Wild Things Are, and I think I was still buzzing from it and trying to figure it out, and that's what screwed me up for Where the Wild Things Are. But Ladies and Gentlemen, Broncos. I just want to do Serious Man someday.
Who are the Coen brothers?
Yeah, I don't know those guys.
They wrote a book. Tom didn't read.
Well, we'll probably, I don't know, when things slow up, we can have like a Coen brothers episode.
All right, good.
Yeah.
But next week,
Gentleman Broncos opens, so we'll be discussing that, and then we'll be doing Kelly Wand's 3x3 about movies that are saved by their last moments. So this has been – go ahead, Kelly.
I just feel like there should be more investment for listeners. Like, we should have some kind of contest where if they guess a DVD, they win a Super 8 print of it.
You were trying to foist off copies of your student film on people.
No one bit, so I'm glad that worked out. But I don't know. I mean, I think – aren't podcasts about contests and reality TV and stuff? Is
that so
people only listen if they think they can win something.
I don't know. Well, we'll float that. So in the meantime, though, if you want to make it more like reality TV, Kelly, eat some live worms and then, put a small child in a balloon and set it free.
Also, be sure to link up the contest at the bottom of this podcast.
See, that kid was kind of like Max in a way, like if it had really happened.
And if he had a domineering, crazy father.
Right. Well, that would have been a good movie.
All right. So this has been the 1-2-3 movie podcast. Thank you for listening. And we will see everyone next week.
Good night.